Blog Talk Radio.
When I was pregnant in jail, I thought I was going to have a baby and the baby would never be with me, but I was acquitted a month and 3 days before Tupac was born. I was real happy because I had a son.
When I was young, me and my mama had beef, 17 years old, kicked out on the street. Though back at the time, I never thought I'd see a face. Ain't a woman alive that could take my mama's place. Suspended from school, I'm scared to go home. I was the fool with the big boys breaking all the rules. Shed tears with my baby sister. Over the years, we was poor than other little kids. And even though we had different daddies, the same drama when things went wrong, we blamed mama. I reminisce on the stress I caused. It was hell, hugging on my mama from a jail cell. And who thinking elementary? Hey, I see the penitentiary one day. Running from the police, that's right. Mama catch me, put a whoop into my backside. And even as a crack fiend, mama, you always was a black queen, mama. I finally understand, for a woman it ain't easy trying to raise a man. You always was committed, a poor single mother on welfare. Tell me how you did it, there's no way I can pay you back. But the plan is to show you that I understand. You all appreciate it.
Yes, that's
right.
Dear
mama,
how do I bring her in?
Place no one above you. You all appreciate it. Don't you know we love you? There ain't nobody tell us it was fair. No love for my daddy, cause the coward wasn't there. He passed away and I didn't cry. Cause my anger wouldn't let me feel for a stranger. They say I'm wrong and I'm heartless. But all along I was looking for a father, he was gone. I hung around with the thugs, and even though they sold drugs, they showed a young brother love. I moved out, started really hanging. I needed money of my own, so I started slanging. I ain't guilty, cause even though I sell rocks, it feels good putting money in your mailbox. I love paying rent when the...
We're here at Blog Talk Radio. This is Mask with Mothers in Activists speaking out on incarceration. My guest today is Miss Donice Watson, and I hope that she can hear us.
I'm going to call in Cassandra.
Hi. Yes.
Are you on the phone and using the you don't need the phone.
Okay. Hello, Donice, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Ah, oh, beautiful. There we go. So this is our first part one radio talk show. And we want to give a shout out to Leona for inviting us and giving us this platform to raise our voices. Donice and I are two mothers, like we said, generations apart, but we share similar and very different outcomes to our stories of incarceration and mothers who have rebuilt their life after the carceral system. Donice, this is a new platform for us. So welcome. And what I guess I could start, or would you like to start? We're just having a conversation.
So I think it would be ideal for you to start, but I want to lift up I want to say my mentor, Dr. Omar Reed. I believe he's on the call also, and I invited him in just to kind of add his psychological expertise around this conversation. So I just want to make sure that we have him included on the call. Are you here, Dr. Reed?
Oh, yes. Hold on. Let me see if I can do anything to assist that. Dr. Reed, are you with us? Like, I know what I'm doing right now. Dr. Reed? I may have muted us. Unmute and...
Okay. Well, while we're working on the technical things, you got
Let me start then, okay?
Yes.
Welcome, Dr. Reed. I see that you're here, and I hope we're going to be able to hear from you. Thank you for joining us. So my name is Cassandra Ben-Sahi, and I am the coordinator for Massachusetts Against Solitary Confinement and also the senior organizer for Unitarian Universalist Mass Action Network. That's the honored title that I carry today. Many years ago, I was a mother with a substance disorder who was taken away from her children, not to get from my disorder, but to serve time in this Framingham State Women's Prison. That was the judge's decision. It wasn't a decision that many of my white counterparts had received with their same disorder, but it was mine. Even though I was sentenced to do 1 year for this disorder, which was not treatment because there's nothing therapeutic about prison, I served 6 months of that sentence. And then I pleaded guilty to something I did not do in order to get parole. Those 6 months gave me a 10-year felony record. It took me 3 years to get my children back from the state, 3 years to find housing, and 3 years to change my life around. I worked really hard. And the only way that this work was possible was after I dealt with my substance disorder that was still an issue when I came home. I was able to connect with a community organization that was working with people who had been inside to use their voice to make some meaningful changes in laws in our state of Massachusetts and meaningful changes in community, what community organizing and leadership look like. This organization gave us a place at the table, an opportunity to build relationships with the legislators that make the laws. You know, my substance disorder was the direct result of having been shot by a 22 rifle, jealous man. I lived through that, got introduced to pain medication, and it made all the trauma that I carried and everything that went with it go away. So years and years later, everything caught up with me. And I can honestly say, as I look back, I would give anything to have spared my children what they went through on my road to recovery and wellness, because they carry a lot of the trauma along with us. It's always hard to remember all of that pain. I also remember feeling less than human, nothing like a mom, when I went into prison, being treated as if I was a loser, somebody that didn't matter. I worked for less than minimum wage, and I always remember swinging this big giant mop to mop the floors inside. They called it the Framingham Shuffle. You know, there was so much humiliation. And I felt physically, sexually assaulted by the strip searches, by the way the guards talked to me. And some of them were nice, but you knew, you learned really quickly who had empathy and who was just there to torture you. But we went along with it, and I made it out. I met a lot of women inside that I've left behind. Some of them were not coming home like I was. I promised to stay in touch, and of course, life caught up with me, and I didn't. But I'm really grateful to be an organizer today, and I became an organizer to use my voice to talk about what we go through as mothers, what we survived, and how we can break that intergenerational harm that prison, mental illness along with addiction causes. You know, I don't have any excuses for the things that I did, but today I hold my head up because I did turn it around. I got out there and I used my voice with others to change some laws, like the Primary Caretakers Act, that said if a parent has a substance disorder, they don't have to be sentenced to jail. They gave the judge another tool to send the family as a unit for healing. And hopefully many women will take advantage, and men, of that in Massachusetts as we educate prosecutors and judges on how to apply that law. It's been my honor to work with other people who have been incarcerated, and they're some of the greatest leaders I've ever met. Truly, when we come to the table and share our experience and our hopes for change from the eyes of the people that sat behind those walls in those cages, that's when we hope to change hearts and minds of what needs to happen to make it better. You know, only we, I believe, can keep us safe. The over-policing, the isolation starts in the courtroom. What we do after we come from over that wall, is going to make all the difference in the world. Families, to our people, and to our community. So today my work is about ending the harmful, torturous use of solitary confinement, which they call restrictive housing in Massachusetts. You know, the system is self-correcting itself so that it can continue to operate the same way that it's been operating, by changing names, sort of a shift-changing monster. But it doesn't change for the people that it's applied to. They are still torturing people with no social redeeming quality. Today is that moment that we know that we can make a difference by telling people that this is not working, that the money that we put into the system is not yielding the results that our community needs. I became a community leader and I realized that I wanted to be that person back in the day when I totally looked up to Angela Davis and all the work that the Black Panthers were doing in our communities. And then I lost my way. But I came back when I met this community organization, and we need more organizations like that to welcome people home, to help them step into their leadership, to help them see that they too are a part of the community. We are people. We moved from our community, and people returned to our community. It's my hope to make that humanity narrative that we share with the stakeholders in our carceral system so that people can have an opportunity to get better and not be worse. And I don't, there's so much more I could say. My story, I wish that I had stepped out of those walls and stepped into something more powerful. But in the end, when I found organizing, I found a community that welcomed me. I worked long hours. I was the last one in the office. And you know what? It changed me. And what is that saying? Andre Lord, I think everything that we touch changes us, and everything you changes you, and everything you change. Oh God, I can't even think of it, but I love that saying. All I know is that I'm here for my people. I'm here for those who need us the most, people that don't have a voice, and I'm here. I'm accountable today, so I'm holding DOC accountable for the way they hold people and the way they treat our people. And that goes for everybody. Thank you so much for listening. I think I'll stop now and let my guests share.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Thank you so much, Sister Cassandra, for opening us up with a real conversation that I think is hard to have. But
yeah.
When you have it, you realize how many people share that same story. So as she introduced, my name is Donnie Watson. I'm a practicing behavioral health specialist on the track to becoming a recognized licensed mental health counselor in our state of Massachusetts. And as our sister stated, that's not who I always was. Can we mute the phone around us, please?
Man, ain't that a Christmas present for y'all ass?
Sister Cassandra, can you mute our audience?
I'm just learning all of these systems, and I'm going to.
Gotcha. Sounds like you muted everybody. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. This is Dr. Reed.
Okay.
Hey,
okay,
Dr.
Good.
Reed.
Good.
Yeah, how you doing, sister?
Very good. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you. Go ahead, Sister Denise.
So, great. So, as I introduce myself, I'm Denise Watson. And today I am the woman that I work hard to be. And as my sister Cassandra mentioned, this is not who we always were. Cassandra, I just want to talk a little bit about this. It's really important. I met Cassandra over the past few months. You know, COVID-19 has changed us and shaped us in ways that we probably wasn't ready for. It was a time where we turned on our TVs and we just saw, like, a lot of violence happening amongst our people. And I wasn't sure what, if anything, I can do. So I just joined in to these different organizations that were talking about causes that was great to me. And so I met my sister Cassandra in the midst of a conversation around incarceration. Now, through my last 10 years, I hardly ever talk about what I've gone through because I wanted to keep my eye on the prize. So I went to school. Let me back up a notch. At 15 years old, I became a mother. 3 weeks before I became a mother, I was introduced to a life-changing experience. My daughter's father, who was my boyfriend, was murdered. So I was pregnant, and I was expecting a baby, and I was in high school, and I was going to be alone. So that trauma was something that I grew with. I raised my daughter to the best of my ability, but I also found myself entangled in the carceral system, as we know it to be. I've served some prison time. I turned 20 years old in MCI Framingham. And during that period of my life is when I realized how much was already taken from me. I didn't have an idea of how to get it back, but I knew that I had to continue to provide for me and my daughter in a way where we were needed to survive out here. So I stayed tangled up with this system. Until one day I realized that I was going to be serving more time than I could possibly handle. And most importantly, I thought about how that was going to impact my family. I knew that if I went to prison, that I was going to come home, and my daughter, she was going to be exactly who I was, right? She had the potential to be everything, but we live in an environment where you really couldn't see it unless you had that guidance. So I fought for that. I stood in front of the judge and I explained to him that throwing me in prison would only create more harm in my community. And my daughter will then be left to fend for herself. So I was granted an opportunity to change my life. And I chose education. I chose to walk into a college that was very foreign to me and sit in the administration office and cry and fight for my life. That's what I consider it. This is a fight for my life, and not just for me, but for my daughter. So back in 2008, I was able to walk into a college and plant myself in a seat. Learned everything that I could learn in the psychology field on a bachelor level, and I applied it to me. I applied it to my life. I applied it to the people who were around me because I needed to know how I can do better for me. And it was in those moments when I said, you know, when I ever, and if I ever have an opportunity to give back, I want to make sure that I work with young women who were impacted by violence and incarceration in teenage pregnancy, just like I was, who didn't have the opportunity to grow through their story, who had to rob and steal, right? Pay Peter, rob Peter to pay Paul. But today, that's not who I am, right? And I pride myself on the fact that I was able to navigate not only through the criminal system and the incarceration system, but through trauma, which has highly impacted my community, my peers. As my sister Cassandra talked about, trauma was her introduction to drugs, to the penal system, to the generational harm that was caused to her family. So today, the work that I do really focuses on brushing the residue off of our plate that the trauma has left behind. And I don't think we talk about that enough because there's not enough of us who look like us, right, who we can believe have gone through or even survived what we've survived that are talking about this. So I bring to the table today not only my lived experience, I bring my knowledge and my expertise in the mental health field as I continue to practice and apply not just the tools that I use, but to help the individuals that I encounter understand that we all already have those tools, right?
Oh, yeah.
We have these tools that we've been using for years to get by, to get through, to get over, you know? So, you know, in my work, right, as a mental health counselor, as a behavioral health specialist, I don't bring anything new to the table. I just help my people understand that you have the tools. You are the expert. We're just the GPS in this, right? You want to go somewhere, let me know where you want to go, and I'm going to help you get there.
Yes,
but you got to drive the car. But you have to drive the car. So as I wrap my story up a little bit, I want to lead that into my mentor who became my mentor. He was my first boss. And a lot of this he's heard, but he didn't really know. I don't think he knows that I was working at his organization when I had my last run-in, my last wrap-up, let me call it, with the incarceration system. It was sitting in those clinical meetings as an intake coordinator, as a receptionist for this doctor, this powerful man, where I gained the power and the knowledge to know that I, too, can be anything that I want to be.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed hearing everything that he said in every single meeting. And I followed through. So today, I'm so proud to be able to call him up and say, Doc, can I include you on a radio show? And we're going to talk about mental health. Because I earned my seat at the table.
So right on.
I want to introduce Dr. Reed.
Dr. Reed, let me just say thank you so much to Sister Dionysse for all that she has done and all that she has become. Because if we're going to talk about, I guess, rehabilitative-based safety, we have to address the harms that hold people accountable. And we have to bring about healing and accountability. That means we have to tackle the harms that go unaddressed by our carceral system. They perpetuate all of the trauma, like domestic violence and sexual abuse and loss of life. You know, we're trying to shift away from fear to care. And I thank you for what you have done in Donisa's life. My sister calls you her mentor, Dr. Reed. And I thank God that you've been there for her, because she is a true asset to our community. So with that, welcome, Dr. Reed.
Okay, but thank you. I'm glad to be here. I'm so proud of the sister, too, because she's been through a lot.
Been your role in Sister Donisa's life, Dr. Reed?
I think I would say surrogate older brother, father, the
right
black man up the street that she can get and somebody messing with her.
Yeah.
I'm that roughneck that she can always call on. You know what I mean? So
yeah.
I'm just I met Donisa years ago, and so proud of her. Encouraged her to go to school. She was very bright when I met her. Shop. And about business, you know, as a single parent for a black woman, that's a hard job to do anyway.
Yes.
And then her daughter was just dynamite as an athlete and student. So she was there for her. But she went through a lot of trauma getting to that. You know, just a lot of stuff she went through, losing the father, the murder, just a lot of things that it's hard for a lot of people to shake. She went up, you know, going through that. I think one of the things she talked about is a lot of the other issues, relationships with men that were just, but also keeping the course. Because understanding that a lot of men have not been raised properly how to respect a black woman, how to work with a black woman, and understand how the system pits us against each other. So when we see soap operas like Atlanta Housewives and, you know, Basketball Wives and things like that to put a black woman in a bad light, a lot of black men have a negative attitude towards black women, and they've been conditioned to do that.
Yeah.
Because if you put a black, strong black man and a smart black woman together, you produce strong black children. They don't want that to happen. So this is all set up to happen this way.
Yeah.
That's why if a black woman is murdered by a black man, no one cares. You ain't going to get no time, maybe a year or two. But kill a white woman, you're in trouble. And what killed me, George Floyd was horrific. Man that blew off the black woman's face. Who slapped her on the butt coming out of the store, and she got mad at him, and he shot her in the face. You didn't even hear about that. That was on Columbus, Ohio. You see what I'm saying? So the black woman's life is basically devalued. So what a lot of black women go through is the system that's been perpetuated to be against you, not only from white, but also from black men who have been brainwashed. And I'm not going to call them black men because there's a difference. There's a difference between a nigger and a black man. The difference between a nigger and a black man is this. A black man is family-centered. He respects the woman. A nigger disrespects the woman.
Yes.
He's self-centered. A nigger thinks about himself. The black man thinks about his community.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a big difference. So sometimes women said to me, why do black men all do this? And I said, well, I don't know any black men do. I know some niggas that do that. That's different. And it's a big difference.
Wow.
You know, and in order to be a black man, you have to be educated and groomed and taught how to be a black man. And unfortunately, our education system does not teach black men how to be black men. It teaches them how to be niggas. It also teaches them how to be a slave.
Yeah.
So it doesn't teach them economic independence, respect the black woman, respect the heritage. So therefore, we kill each other by the thousands. We disrespect black women, right? And that's become, the man benefits from that because we're a multi-trillion dollar business.
Oh, yes.
In fact, you can keep us dysfunctional. The budget, you know, the money they're pulling up for this bailout bond, if you invest in niggas, you'll balance that budget out in 2 years.
Oh, yeah, and keep the prisons
full. Between diabetes, incarceration rate, personalized prisons, I mean, we'll sell the budget easy. We'll balance the budget out by using us alone.
That's not what
we
want.
And that's one of the things, too, that when you see this, It can be depressing, but when I hear stories of you two sisters and other black women who are about business, it makes me feel good. And also the young black men who are coming up that I worked with over the years who are doing the right thing, respecting black women where they should be.
Oh, we need so much more of that.
Absolutely.
You know, Dr. Reed, trauma is a chief cause. It's the main cause of violence.
Absolutely.
It results in violence, okay? But our democracy and the disparities in inequity, people don't understand that when a community is poorer than another community, it takes more to bring that community up to where it should be. You know,
mm-hmm.
if we work on the economic inequalities growing by bounds, and as well as the explosion of our prison populations, we can see that there's so much suffering and damaging. And we see the
mm-hmm.
real threat to our safety is not coming from the people that are violent in our communities, but it's actually coming from the systems of racism and capitalism and the things that are holding our own families and communities hostage as prisoners, slaves.
Oh,
we
yeah,
want to move away from that by people like you, people like the work that we're doing and other organizations in our communities. It has to spread like a virus to reach
mm-hmm.
out to people. And we have to shift away again from fear of people to care.
Even having these conversations, is a start, right? When I think about
mm-hmm.
over the summer, this past summer I held an event that I launched under my personal business, Crossroad Counseling Service, right? When we talk about rebuilding and reimagining our communities, we can't have this conversation in smaller pockets, right? We have to
mm-hmm.
be broad with it. So I held an event this summer, and I called it Keeping It 100 with 100 Women. And because
yes,
of
I
COVID
was there.
You know, precautions, right, because of
yeah.
COVID precautions, you know, I didn't expect the turnout to be what it was, but I had about 80-plus women show up because they wanted to hear something from somebody real, right? Because
yes.
so we can turn on the TV and, you know, there's so many depictions of black women, like Dr. Reed mentioned,
mm-hmm.
whether they're good or bad, but these aren't women that we can touch. Right? Like
yeah.
it's time that like people like us, we have to speak up and we have to step out and model what reimagining our community, reimagining our families. We have to model what that looks like. And we can't
right.
do that without having conversations like this, right? And
yeah.
what we talked about at the 100 Women event was domestic violence, trauma, right? We talked
yeah.
about incarceration, you know, being single mothers and just how we can tie it back to, you know, being snatched away, our babies being sold from us, right?
Yeah.
Our men being sold from us, how we've been accustomed and trained through the years to be without family, to
mm-hmm.
be without
mm-hmm.
Our children and to not understand what nurture is, right? Like, so we have a misrepresented and misunderstood generation coming up. You know, these
oh,
children
yeah.
and the individuals that are causing harm and allowing the profits to happen in the incarceral system are the babies of us traumatized, the last two traumatized generations.
Oh,
and I
yes.
don't think we've had those conversations enough to really take our stance. You know what I'm saying? To say,
yeah.
okay,
mm-hmm.
you know what? Not only am I responsible for my child, I'm responsible for these children. Right?
Yeah.
So the work
mm-hmm.
that we're doing, and I'm responsible for these mothers, right? I'm not just
yeah.
The success of me and what I do for me is great. But what I can ensure happens in my community and around me allows greatness to continue. You know,
yeah.
and these
mm-hmm.
conversations we have to continue to have. So when I show up, you know, at events or when I step out, like I try to model what it looks like to still be who I am, but it's
yes.
Right?
Oh,
like
yes.
when you know better, you're able to do better.
Yes,
so I
you
have
should.
Conversations about mental health all the time, and not because mental health is just about psychotherapy, because it's about healing. It's about
yeah.
it's about feeling good. You know what I mean? And I
oh yeah,
years through causing harm, right? So now
yeah.
I turn back around and I look at my community, and here I am. I feel good, and I'm walking through a community that just don't feel good.
Yeah,
you know what
yeah.
I'm saying?
Yeah.
So
right.
I'm so blessed and grateful to be able to have these conversations with sisters like Cassandra, who's out here talking about ending solitary confinement. And
yeah.
I resonate with what it felt like being confined, not only in the prison, then my own self.
Okay? Right on.
Like when we
right
talk,
on.
When we talk about that, like, you know, you can be confined. You can be locked in a box,
mm-hmm.
you know, and stuck in one place. But imagine you walking around locked in a box.
Oh,
you
mm-hmm.
know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And raising
yeah.
locked
that's
in a box
hard to
children.
Shake.
And tarnishing, raising locked in a box children. It's not
yeah.
their fault.
Yeah.
But accountability, right, is I. So I stand in accountability today, and I say, not only am I accountable to make sure that I'm good, I'm taking accountability to help those who have their car started, right? The GPS
yeah.
is here.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and Dr. Reed, what he brings is that model of not only is he a doctor, a mental health counselor, he's a dad, he's a member
yeah.
of the community. His story's deep, too. You know, he talked about how he was impacted by racism and in a community lived alcoholism, but what made him do what he's doing and not what Willie and Bobo and Boom Boom did, right?
Right,
what
right.
made
somebody believed. In him. Somebody was a mentor
right.
to him.
Or
and somebody saw what he could be. You know? I mean,
right.
I want to say you made a really good point. What I heard you say is, you know, there was a long time before I never imagined that I would share my story over 11 years after it happened. Why would I want to relive that? I'm not ashamed today, okay? Because I know that story can change the narrative for other people. Because I truly was and am a good person. I am, I contribute to my community. You know, there was so much more to me than what my worst moment was. You know, I'm so grateful that I was given the opportunity to say, hey, this is who I was. But look, I'm 100% who I am today because of my journey, okay? And it didn't have
mm-hmm.
to be that way. How much shorter could that journey have been had I been given opportunity? You know, I love Angela Davis when she said, and this is me today, sometimes my kids don't want to be around me. You have to radically act as if it's possible to change the world. Radically, and you have to act that way all the time. I believe that nothing ever changes without the voice of people. We have made so much happen, and we have so far to go. But we stand in our power today because of the people that hold us up and gave us an opportunity to realize how great we are.
Right.
You know, I have a daughter who's an RA today that I'm so proud of. And my other four daughters that were all traumatized, I have four daughters. Three of them, they're all doing well, but I still walk through some trauma with them. But you know what? Traumatized people raise traumatized children. So I refuse
mm-hmm.
to be a traumatized woman today. I don't stand for it, okay? Seek wellness wherever it's offered. You know, trainings like BOLD, Black Organized Teachers for Leadership and Development, that teach us to embody stuff, make positive practices, practice it over 300 times until it becomes a part of you, and walk in the light, not in the darkness. And it's okay to look back at our past, but we don't stare at that. Look forward to what is possible in the future. And those are the models. And I get so much joy when my sisters come up and come all they can be. I'm the first one to say, hey, right on, sister. You know, I feel that pride. Because I know the struggle is real. And I know anybody that comes out of it is a hero and a resilient survivor. Those are the things that give me hope today. And the children of the future, we have a lot of young Black leaders that are coming up, and they've gone to great schools. They can talk that talk and walk the walk. We are a great people, you know?
Awesome. That's true.
Yeah. Man, this is a good conversation. I love it.
Right. And when we talk about, you know, you said something, resiliency. Dr. Reed, can you shed some light on resiliency for us and what that means for us as a people?
Yeah, it's be able to, like, when things happen, be able to persevere through it. A lot of times, a lot of people aren't resilient. They crack under pressure. I think a lot of Black women, there was a thing on television where this white woman, she fainted. She passed out because she was overwhelmed because she was a stay-at-home mom and had to take care of the kids, and she had to work when her husband had a heart attack. It was too much for her. And I laughed because, again, she wasn't resilient. Black woman been resilient. You had to do everything. Clean, work two jobs, deal with fools, you know, and do everything. So we see a lot of resiliency in our community with a lot of Black women.
Yeah.
One of the problems that happens sometimes is that no one gives you credit for what you do. There's an assumption that, oh, you're supposed to do that. You're a Black woman.
Yeah.
But guess what? You get tired, too. Also, I like to be recognized for what I do. It's hard to be a Black woman.
Yeah.
Especially when you're being attacked by so many fronts.
Oh, yes.
Resiliency is a staple that Black women have. I don't know how you all do it, because I think most Black women would slit their own throats with the pressure that y'all go through, because you're being attacked on so many fronts.
We come from a long line of brilliant, strong women. I watched my mother, who became a nurse when they were looking for Black women to be nurses. She worked, 60 to 80 hours a week. Every holiday, she was never home. She provided for 7 children. And when my father decided to turn his life around and become a nurse, she worked while he went to school and helped push him through, because he couldn't work in the school, you know? But, you know, he was a jack of all trades. But in the end, he was successful. But they tried to provide everything that they could to us, but they also never spared the rod, which caused a lot of my trauma, because I wasn't a child that needed to be beat. But I can look back and remember my father talking to us before he beat me. And when his talk was finished, I was willing to do anything to please him, because he worked so hard and had such hopes for me. Once he beat me, man, I was pissed off and angry. I said, I'll keep doing what I'm doing, but I just won't get caught again, you know? Listen, that's the same idea behind punishment in our carceral system, in the torture that they tell on us. We cannot get better like that. And again, it's an intentional system. It's not broken. It's working exactly the way they want it.
The way it's supposed to be.
We want that to change, because our communities are suffering. A lot of those guards, they don't come from our communities. You know that? A few of them do. And I've heard some stories about them calling women names and acting outside of their color and not standing up for us, you know? But a lot of them are white, to interacting with people of color, and I'm talking Black, Brown, LGBT, people that are different than them. They come in there with a preconceived idea that it's them against us. And, you know, you're sent to prison for punishment, not to be punished. That can't be the treatment. And when we get outside of that, I think it's going to take a community to heal us, because they don't care inside those walls. But I know that everything goes on inside those walls with no accountability, with no cameras like we saw with George Floyd. Everything that's done behind those walls affects our communities, because 90% of those people are coming home. And the over-policing, the disproportionate sentencing in the courts, the lack of support from lawyers, which is why I love the participatory defense model of helping the lawyer represent you to humanize people, is so important, okay? A lot of time is being saved on people's lives because of community work and involvement, and because of mentors like you, Dr. Reed, and mentors like community organizers that are holding people and offering training and knowledge in a way for us to be able to be a part of the community. You know, I'm big on these sayings, but you know that saying, there's an African folktale that says, if a child can't feel the warmth of the fire, set the village on fire in order to feel the warmth of the fire.
Right.
We want to burn something down sometime because we don't have ownership in it. We don't have agency. We have to make people feel wanted, accepted. We have to have living wage jobs. We have to have education opportunities. We have to have mentors for our men, our women, for people to realize, yeah, we're resilient. Yeah, we're survivors. But what can we be more of? How can we help each other to be better?
Right.
To be life, moving towards life. And that came from Adrienne Marie Brown. Life moving towards life. I love it. And I love you all.
Right.
I love you for being here with us. Like I said, this is part one. We're so grateful to be able to try this out. This is practice, but this is real life. This is our life. And I just want everybody to know that we're out here. We're here for people. There are people like Dr. Reed. There are the Dionysus, the therapists. There are the organizers like myself that care, and we will fight until something more changes in our generation. I have beautiful grandkids today. I don't want them to suffer. I want them to be all they can be. And I don't want them to have to fight. I've been marching since I was 16 for one cause or another. And I'm not tired yet. You know, I'm not tired. I'm going to stand on my feet. I'll die marching, okay? Because I know that we are worth it. And I always add, incarcerated lives matter too. So where do we start? How would you like guys like to end this?
Well, I like to say that, I like to add on to what you just said. Like, where do we start? We have to start individually, right? We have to work on ourselves, because we got to be able to fight, right? We got to be able to march. And some of us are carrying a lot of baggage. Some of us are carrying a lot of baggage. And we got to be able to be, we got to be well for ourselves, you know. So even in the midst of the work that I do, you know, I want to uplift the fact that I've found myself wrapped into a little yoga community, a little healing community, right? And I realize how important that is for me, for my self-care, if I continue to do the work. So I want to make sure that we uplift the fact that
this work can't be done unless we're taking care of self, right?
Right.
And we all got a little something that we can work on. So don't be afraid to do that. You know, like, this is the time. If there's no other time, now is really the time to say, you know what? What can I do for self, right?
That's so important.
And then the next step is community. But I, you know, Cassandra, I thank you so much for just for bringing me to this platform, because it means a lot.
Mm-hmm.
To think
I'm so
about,
honored,
like,
to have you at my side.
Right, but when we have these conversations, we're thinking about mass incarceration. We're thinking about all of the individuals who are incarcerated, you know. Khalif Browder is, like, my text messages are binging right now, and someone's saying, this conversation is giving me, like, Khalif Browder vibes, you know.
When you're thinking about
individuals, you know, in solitary confinement and what that means, and how mental health is so important, you know.
Yeah.
And I said something, I had it was a presentation about a month or so ago, and I was talking about Crossroads Counseling Services, which is my upcoming baby, and I talked about what it's going to be to the community. But I wanted to make sure that I highlighted that, you know, for years they say, you know, black people got it's a stigma around mental health for black and brown people, and it's like, no, you know. It's not the mental health that the stigma's around. It's the mental illness, right?
Yeah.
We enjoy being mentally healthy. We go to church, you know, we get our hair done, we look good, we feel good. That's what mental health means to us, right? It's the mental illnesses that we don't want to talk about, the depression, you know, the symptoms behind that, the anxiety, the post-traumatic stress disorder. Like, that's the stuff that we as black and brown people want to shy away from. So when I talk about mental health, I'm talking about the mental health, the healthy part of the mental state, right?
How
do we get our mental state to be healthy and to stay healthy? So just destigmatize it. You know, help me destigmatize what it means to receive, to have a healthy mental state, period.
Yeah.
You know, like,
I'm not afraid of that stigma anymore today. Like, you know, the first thing I lift up is, I go to therapy, you know, I'll do whatever it takes to be well. And I promote that. We cannot be afraid to listen. I'm not mental. Look, they made me jump through hoops to get my kids back from DCF, you know, anger management. I'm like, I've been a mother all my life. They belong with me. What do you mean I have to prove to you that I can take care of my kids? Give me my babies back.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I did it. I went to an anger management class, and it was ran by a little old white lady. And let me tell you something. Me and a few other women, one of the girls, the lady asked her, how would you deal with this situation? And when the girl just said, listen, I'm that bitch out, like, she was like, well, my like she was shocked at some of our answers and shocked at some of the things that we had to go through. I didn't find the class particularly helpful, okay, because I know that a week after I left that class, something happened at my job. I was challenged by an angry woman, and I ended up punching her in the face. I said, oh my god, I just graduated anger management. Oh, please, I'm sorry. I tried to dust the girl off, right? Listen, you know, trauma is real. Don't try me. But it took me years to learn where to put my anger. It took me years to learn not to let my emotions overrule my intelligence. It took me a while to stop shoplifting. Okay? Things just become a way of life. And I don't have to be that way anymore because I've been given opportunities. I don't want people to think that they can't be more. I want to be that model. And I want my life, the way I live, my integrity, to speak louder than my words. If that's possible, yes. You know?
Mm-hmm.
I looks like we have 34 minutes left. Is that true?
Maybe we can open it up if the audience or if Dr. Reed has something he wants to close on as well, and then if you have any questions from people.
Yeah.
I
had a conversation with a young man the other day who was very upset about what's going on, you know, economics for black people in the country right now.
Yes.
And he talked about he's a Democrat and he's going to go independent because he felt that when the House was controlled by the Democrats and the Senate, nothing was done for black people in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And he was upset because he was upset about Kamala Harris, who said she wasn't black, but also she said she was black during the election.
Yeah.
And how Biden was so racist, he was against integrating the schools, and how things have changed, but people only use us to get what they want. But in the long run, nothing's ever done to help us.
Yes.
And I said to him, what would you expect the Democrats to do? And he said, I just help us out, you know, help us, Dr. Reed. And I said, well, why would they help us if they're making millions of dollars off of us?
Yeah, you can't expect
that's
the oppressor
like
to show you how to
dealer,
get free.
Saying to a drug dealer, I want all your folks to go into rehab. Well, that's good, but I ain't going to make no money.
Yeah,
so the
right?
thing is that the Dixiecrat, the Republican, all are the same.
Yeah.
The difference is that we cannot expect a government group or political group to help us. We have to help ourselves. We have to start our own businesses. We have to work for ourselves.
Amen.
No
Amen.
White person or white institution is going to liberate black people in this country when they make trillions of dollars off us.
Right.
It's never going to happen.
Hmm.
So we need to understand that. Like, you don't see Asians, you don't see Vietnamese walking around, we want jobs, to complain about the white man. You don't see Greeks, Italians, Irish, Polar, you know, people
right.
from Venezuela, Guatemala complain about a job for white. It's only us for a job. Because we've been duped, not by white people, but the so-called black Negro leaders that the white man puts in power. Because they'll keep telling us to blame the white man. When they're in on it, it's a scam. It's a ruse.
Yeah.
Because the white man has nothing to do with our condition.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think about it. The Vietnamese, I almost got drafted in Vietnam. So the Vietnamese came here in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
They've been here. They own everything from South Boston all the way up to Ashmont Station.
Wow.
They still don't speak the language, most of them, and
mm-hmm.
they employ 99% of their people.
Beautiful. Yeah.
How long we've been here? There's not one black business. Now, remember, Boston's supposed to be the most progressive place for black people in the country.
Yeah.
If you compare us to other cities, blacks are doing better than any other part of the country. I travel a lot. St. Louis can't touch us, D.C., Atlanta, nobody.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not one black business district in Boston.
Wow.
Because
Dr. Reed, I used to consider Dudley, as a black hub, like, you know. I could, but it was
other black
people.
There, but we never owned
people.
The businesses.
Right. That's what sucks. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, Ferdinand's was Jews.
Wow.
Remember Purity Supreme? When you go back to Purity Supreme and all those back in the day, it was all white folks that owned them.
Taking our money.
All the stores down there were owned by whites who hired blacks to work for them when the population
changed. Remember, was it Shabazz Restaurant on Grove Hall?
Yeah. Oh,
that
yeah.
was all black, and that was, right?
Yeah.
And that was the Muslims, right? And they made the best bean pies. Muhammad Ali came there.
Absolutely.
You know,
barbecue beef sandwiches. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Chuck's Barbershop. It was like so much, you know?
But
why
see, all that died out. And see, that's part of the scam. Like, when we look at the Mecca in Grove Hall, not one of those businesses are owned by black folks there. Barbershop is white. Bank America is white. All the stores are owned by foreigners. And then you got CVS.
Yeah.
So
how
what
do
is the
we?
Message?
We've got to. You know that. I know there's movements. I know there's people out there working. You know, I believe. You know, Faith Justice is an organization that's out there doing different things. But What's that organization that has the credit union and the bank? God, I'm sorry. I will be better on the next show. More information. We need exactly what you're saying, Dr. Reed. You know.
So when you look at that, when you look at that, and we look at the condition of black people, remember Boston Post, we're the best place. We're doing better for black people here than any part of the country.
Okay.
The more educated black in Boston, if you go from State Street, Boston, a 20-mile radius, and I'm giving you what Mitt Romney quoted me. This is from Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. There are more educated black people in Boston within the 20-mile radius of State Street that have a bachelor's degree above.
Wow. Beautiful.
More so than anywhere in the country.
But we need
Boston.
Businesses. We need people to be employed.
99% of them work for institutions. They work for public sector. Think about our friends and where we work. They either work for the state, the city, right?
Yeah.
Or nonprofits or educational institutions.
Yeah. Uh-huh. We got to be homeowners.
So, in the private sector, still don't hire us.
It's a whole nother radio show.
right?
Really taken back. Honestly, I've adopted that model. Back 12, 14 years ago when I met Dr. Reed, I learned then, like, wait a minute. He said something that I'll never forget. He said, I wasn't born a slave, and I'm not going to die a slave. And I was looking at this man. I said, something's not right with this man. But the more that I learned where he was coming from, I'm like, this is exactly what I needed to hear. I've never heard anyone, because he owned his organization, everyone who worked for him looked like him or me, you know, with the exception of, I don't know, but it was the real. So this is a whole great conversation that needs its own show, because we really have to talk about how the black dollar needs to go through the community 4 or 5 times.
Man.
You know,
we don't have the ability to do that. You just took me back, and I remember when I was coming up and I lived in Roxbury, I had a black gynecologist who had his own business. His name was Dr. Campbell.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going too far back? Does anybody remember Dr. Campbell?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, my God. First black doctor that I'd ever met, and he was my doctor forever and ever. And I had so much respect. I knew we could be doctors. My mom became a nurse. We need to see people with businesses. We need businesses. We need home ownership. We need that inclusiveness to feel like we're not being pushed out to the margins, you know? Why do we all have to work? My job today with my coworkers, I feel like I'm a boss, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And she makes me feel that way. She allows me to be in my own power to make decisions. And it's beautiful. It's a good feeling. And when you enjoy what you do, you never have to work a day in your life.
Mm-hmm.
There's a
system
that comes with having your own sense of agency, of having your own power, a certain sense of power. Comes with that too. People need to feel empowered. I thank you for lifting that. That is so important. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that we can see in this time, in this moment, equal rights moment, I hope that we can create more agency, more places for people to thrive and come into their own.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they're ready. We just have to take that lead. You know, we have to have some business training courses, and I know those are being offered through BU. We have to have people that are brave enough to say, yeah, give me that money. I'm going to do my own thing, you know, my own business.
Mm-hmm.
I was even hoping that black people were going to be cannabis owners, if that was going to be, you know, man, they didn't even want to open it up when we legalized it. And I remember they opened up that first one in Northampton, And I think it was either their mayor or governor came in there and brought something as a souvenir, he said. I was like, uh-huh. But they made so much money in that first month. It took 2 years to open the first one. About 6 months after that, they had opened up 6 or 7 new ones, man. And none of us could get in. You know, business owners, where the money is being made. I have a son who's working on his own business. He has his business out here in California, who I'm visiting, who I'm so proud of. He's had that entrepreneur mindset for a long time. It's important that we shift and stop thinking about how we support the system, but how the system can support our initiatives, you know, what our people need, and how we can hire our people. I share the wealth whenever I can with my people. Any monies I can share, I do, because I know we need it. But we need more. And these are the conversations that we're going to focus on. What can be possible for a more vibrant, inclusive future? We want all people to. There's enough wealth for all of us to survive. Not just survive, to dig in and really make it. You know? We hope to do that.
Right.
I believe it's possible.
Absolutely.
Let's see what the next session does bring to us. More insight. Again, I love you guys so much. I don't know how, if someone calls in, how to bring them on, or how to even tell. I know my sister Leona is listening in, and I don't know if we have any callers that have any questions for us, so I'm going to issue a deep apology right now if there are questions out there and we can't get to you, but I promise to be more savvy about this radio station that we've been honored to be a part of for the next time. But with that, I have so much love and respect for y'all. And thank you for being here with me.
Thank you for having us. Dr. Reed, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Anytime.
Dr. Reed, you are deep, brother. You got it going on.
Oh, thank you, sister. Thank you.
Listen, the brother gets deeper, you know. He gave me a book years ago. And the book is called Post-Traumatic Slavery Disorder, right? When he put this book in my hand, I was like, you know what? And this is before my journey into college.
Did he write the book?
And I was, like I said, yeah, I was 1 foot in his office and the other in the street. And so when he put this book in my hand, I was like, this dude is something else. And I said, you know what, God, just lead me, because I didn't land at this place via a temp agency for nothing.
Okay.
Like, this has to be a sign in my life. And I've been inspired by this man to continue and further my education. And so today I'm proud to just be able to say thank you, Dr. Reed. I never said it, I know I've said it a whole bunch of times. Like, let me highlight that this guy, he was my boss. And he invested in my daughter. She was 8th, 9th grade, you know. I had these basketball dreams for her, and they came true, right? But it was so early on. He token on I didn't see it coming. And he said, "Oh, you'll get more, and she'll be able. Everything will go well from here." And he didn't lie.
Great today.
He saw it. You know what I mean? Or either he spoke it into existence. Whatever he did, I believed, and I said, "You know what? I'm gonna walk like that brother walked." Whatever he's saying, how he did it, I'm going to do it, because I've never seen this before, and I like these results, right?
Right on.
So I thank you, Dr. Reed, as I'm holding your book in my hand right now.
Give us the name of that book again.
Post-Traumatic Slavery Disorder.
Right on, Dr. Reed. Thank you. Thank you for your wisdom and your vision and for the the ability to lift up our people and pull us out by being so real and sharing yourself with us. I love when Dani shows up with that little sign in the background. I came to learn something.
And I hope that
we have been able to share some knowledge today, that never ever look at our past as, I don't want people wringing their hands and saying, oh, poor, those poor ladies. Let me tell you, my life is second to none. Today, I have relationships all over the country. I'm making a difference in my daughter's lives, my son's lives, and the friends that I have. And I'm proud to be who I am today, even through all that we have to live through, all that we have to fear. I don't carry that fear. I walk with an invisible crown on my head, and yet I remain humble. And I'm here for the people. I see other people have joined our call and then stepped off. But like I said, this is going to get better, okay? We're going to share more. So with that,
well, thank you.
I want to wish you happy holidays. I want to wish everybody inside happy holidays. And I want to use this season of magic to share love and care and make somebody's life different. Oh, thank you guys for being here with us.
Thank you so much.
We're going to end our show. We'll end our show. Blog Talk Radio, thank you for shedding light.
All right.
Thank
you,
Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
How do I end?